Game on 2FM.
With Gillette. Great performances begin with a comfortable close shave from Gillette. Gillette, making men's lives just that little bit easier. Game on. Check out the podcast
on the RTE Radio Player app.
Now, the spread of the coronavirus around the world has impacted the staging of sporting events, and it looks like it could impact the staging of the Ireland versus Italy Six Nations game. The Minister for Health, Simon Harris, has said that he doesn't think it should go ahead. Speaking on the 6-1 News, he delivered that line.
In relation to the Ireland-Italy rugby game, which was due to be held in Dublin on, I think, the 7th of March, the very clear view of the public health emergency team was that this game should not go ahead. That it would constitute a significant risk because a very large number of people would be travelling from what is now an affected region. So my department will be contacting the IRFU in relation to this. I know it'll come as a cause a great disappointment to many, but it is important we make decisions in relation to public health above and beyond all other considerations.
Marie, that's grand, like, but there's two flights due in from Milan in the next 2 hours in Dublin Airport. Probably carrying 180 people each. That's 360 passengers. How many of them are going to land between now and that match is played on Saturday week?
I don't know the answer to that, Ruby.
But if the match is bringing a huge number of people that are a serious health risk, add up all those people that are going to land here from Italy in the next 10 days. It probably equates to more than what are going to the match. Sorry, Simon, but there's more than sport you have to look at here.
Well, Ian O'Riordan of the Irish Times joins us on the line. Ian, did you hear Ruby there? He said there is more than sport that Simon Harris should be looking at. What do you reckon?
Well, I did, yeah. And I was slightly surprised that Simon Harris came out with that statement as early as he has. I mean, it's obviously still 2 weeks to go. And of course, you've got to set all these decisions against two things. Number one, I mean, that the lives are at risk here. We've seen casualties in Italy. And, you know, that's a clear indication of how serious it is. And then you also have to set, I suppose, the short-term pain against the long-term pain. I mean, if you don't cancel maybe the event in the next 2 or 3 weeks, you could be looking at a far worse situation, not just cancelling sporting events and travel. So it's a really tough one. It's a massive dilemma, and every day it seems to be, getting worse. But I do think like a lot of these situations are they're fearing for the worst case scenario. And like Dick Powell, for example, the IOC executive committee member, came out today as well. He was obviously talking about the situation around Tokyo this summer, and we've spoken about that before. And when do you make a decision on that? And it's still far too early to make a decision on that. And he reckoned it'd be 2 months out before you make something of a decision of that scale. But again, you have to sort of constantly offset and say that the short-term pain versus the long-term pain. And of course, yeah, I mean, there may be a minimal risk of the Ireland rugby game going ahead. But should that result in one infection, then you could be looking at a far worse case scenario come the summer. And, you know, something like a European 2020 football championship, which is obviously spread across 12 countries.
And I'm sure as well that Simon Harris was in consultation with the relevant authorities before he said something like that.
Yeah, it's popping up all over here. I mean, even Cheltenham, I mean, I'm sure Ruby was aware of that today as well, that the Cheltenham authorities were mentioned or were asked about what their situation. And as of now, no, they have no... They have no, dare I say, plans to even look at Cheltenham. I mean, it's two weeks ago. That's full steam ahead. There's been no contact from either Britain or Irish racing authorities. But, I mean, that's probably next on the radar in terms of what happens there. Again, and that's why Simon Harris is being ultra-cautious here, because, you know, we've been lucky so far that there hasn't been a corona case in Ireland. But if all it would take was one case, and then you're going to see, then I think you're going to see far more severe consequences.
But Simon, Ian, you look at the sporting events get looked at, but you stand in Dublin Airport every day. How many people leave this country to go on business to all these places? Every day, every hour. Yet people make a mountain out of sporting events. If you want to contain it, you have to stop people travelling on holidays and on business first, not just sporting events.
Yeah, well, I suppose that's the next step, though, Ruby.
That's the first step, surely.
Well, I suppose, yeah. Well, I mean, at the scale of things, I mean, I think the reason why the rugby match has been highlighted is because, I mean, and I think we've seen it with the Pro 12 games as well. I mean, there's areas of Italy where they may be travelling from, and there are restrictions in that part of Italy we've seen as well. Whereas, you know, so obviously when it's a national sporting event, it seems to look. I'm not claiming to be any expert here. What the strategy plan is, and that's why, you know, it's a kind of a it's a kind of a case of, dare I say, people are making this up. Not that they're making it up as they go along, but like nobody knows where we're going to be in 2 or 3 weeks' time or 2 or 3 months' time. And that's why I'm saying, even if you look at some of the Olympic Games, we spoke about this before. I mean, it's far too early for anyone to start of saying, you know, what's the plan B going to be here? But I think you have to offset the short term risks versus the long term risks. But I was still surprised that Simon Harris came out with a statement as early as he did. I think it's probably, you know, the last thing you want to do is start generating any sort of panic as well, which seems to be creeping in a little bit. But I read an interesting line today as well out of Vietnam. Like, Vietnam was one of these countries that had 16 cases in a certain area. They locked that area down. There was a quarantine put in place, and now it's completely clear. They've cleared that. There's actually no infection. So that's an example of maybe you don't hear about that. You know, there are cases whereby if you shut the place down for a certain number of days or weeks, then you can actually get rid of it completely. That's exactly what's happened in Vietnam.
Well, Ian, that's brilliant news. And should we look at something like that and put procedures in place, like Ruby's saying, for everyone travelling? Remember the foot and mouth, you had to go through those, it was like the old school swimming pool things to clear your feet. Is there some form of procedures that could be put in place?
Yeah, well, I don't know. See, again, the problem with the coronavirus is, I mean, the first of all, there's no vaccine. So there's no way of actually preventing it other than just trying to limit the spread of it, essentially. Like, so I don't think there's any way of immunity. There's no sort of vaccine you can take to become immune from it. And that's why the sporting events are, dare I say, being targeted first, because it brings so many people together from so many different countries and so many different backgrounds, all different age groups, all that kind of stuff into a small, you know, it's kind of the perfect storm for a spread of any virus. And, you know, whether it's something that's as contagious as coronavirus or not. But I mean, if you look at the list, I mean, every day, I think it was today we saw as well that, what was it, the World Table Tennis Championships have been cancelled. They were supposed to take place in South Korea. We've seen obviously there's been talk of the Serie A matches have been actually playing behind closed doors in Italy. So that seems to be another step that's a possibility. And that was one of the things I mentioned about the Tokyo Olympics as well, as a worst case scenario, was that, like, the Olympics, by the way, I think 75% of the money comes off the TV rights. So the idea of actually having the Olympics with nobody there except just the TV cameras is not outside the realms of possibility. Yeah.
Dick Pound, as you mentioned, said it's a case of wait and see for the Olympics, but they do have a good bit of lead-in time. So are they going to put something in place for a worst-case scenario? And is there any precedent there, Ian?
Yeah, good question, because I mean, that was one of the things that was suggested. Like, I mean, well, I think some mayor candidate in London said, well, we could hold the Olympics, which I think was a little bit unfair on Tokyo. But I think we'll see how it goes. But if the situation worsens in the next 2 or 3 weeks, I would think that, you know, that's something they might want to look at. And one of the things I heard as well is, again, you just don't know what this is a possibility. They might start excluding countries and say, well, look, when, you know, unfortunately, China, you're just not going to take part. That's just going to be the way it is, which unfortunately would dilute or water down the Olympics as well a lot, or maybe spread it out. But I don't think, I mean, can you defer or postpone the Olympic Games? I mean, it's almost like an immovable feast and such a bubble as well. I mean, the sort of, dare I say, Japan having to say, right, well, we'll carry on until 2021. I don't know. But again, that's getting ahead of ourselves here. And you mentioned Dick Pound there, and he's a bit of a man known for fearing for the worst. But he's certainly saying, look, it's just too soon to tell. And it's funny, I was chatting to a few Irish Olympians over the last few days just about various things, and like Reese McLenaghan yesterday as a gymnast. And you can see it's already impacting a little bit on their thought, kind of, well, you know, is this actually going to happen? And it's very unfortunate from that level, but again, set against the risk for human lives here.
Ruby, we're hoping to have a really big equestrian team there all going to plan. What happens with horses in a case like this? Because I assume they have to go a lot earlier than people.
They do, because they've got through quarantine, obviously being an animal, so they would have to spend 2 weeks in quarantine in Ireland and 2 weeks in quarantine in Japan. So they would be, no, they'd only be there for 2 weeks before they get there. Not any longer than that, and I'm not sure of the exact Olympic program. The equestrian events mightn't start till 2 weeks into the Olympics, so there could be other athletes there before them. So I don't really know when they start. Ian, do you? I have no idea when.
Well, no, but again, I don't think this is not an animal virus per se. So I don't think the horses, dare I say, will be funny enough.
Ian, horses didn't carry foot and mouth either, and they all jelled them off.
Let that go, Ruby, will you?
No, I won't let it go. Because racing got the short end of the stick that time too.
Yeah, no, I agree, but I'm just saying I'm not sure if that's going to make that situation any worse. To be honest, but again, that's something we just don't know. We just don't know whether they're going to have to look at that. Like, I can't imagine anybody. But it's have to think about how that's going to impact on the travel of horses at this stage.
Anyway, it's all coming down the pipeline. Who knows what's going to happen? It'll be interesting. Ian, I went home last night on the advice of Marie Crow to watch Panorama at 8:30, only discovered it was on at 9:30. Did you watch Mo Farah?
Have you not got the plus one then?
There's no BBC One plus one. I went looking for that as well. It was Marie's fault. She told me it was on at 9:30. It was on at 8:30.
Don't draw on you.
Well, yeah, it was. Look, I mean, this was a Panorama documentary about Mo Farah, and I suppose specifically about the Alberto Salazar case, which developed over the last number of years, and he's subsequently banned for 4 years coming out of the World Championships in Doha last year. Yeah, I watched it. I mean, it was kind of classic popcorn TV. It was well done. You're kind of looking at it going, that is quite gripping. But I don't think there was anything necessarily new in there. There was nothing new that we kind of didn't know already, except for one sort of critical period, which they kind of stayed in true kind of gripping fashion until the end, when this was Mo Farah's testimony to the United States Anti-Doping Committee back in 2015 when they first started investigating Salazar. And this was to do with the injections of L-carnitine, which Mo Farah admitted he was taking, but he got his sort of details slightly mixed up. But first of all, he denied that there were actually intravenous injections. He said this to the USADA committee, and then when he actually came out of the hearing, he met with Barry Fudge, who was the head of UK Athletics at the time, and he said, "Well, I hope he told me about the injections." And he was like, "Oh no, I forgot. I need to run back inside and kind of change his story." So It's certainly from that sort of part of it alone didn't make Mo Farah come out of it pretty well. And he's clearly got something to hide here. And this is the problem here. Like, he keeps changing his story with the same about his relationship with Jama Adan, the Somalian coach who has also been banned. And first he said he didn't know him. And secondly he said, well, actually I did know him, but I didn't want to admit knowing him and all this kind of thing. So anybody keeps changing a story like that, I think it is worrying. But also, I think there's nothing really new in the fact that, I mean, they're going on about the L-carnitine injections. And by the way, L-carnitine is not exactly the most powerful performance-enhancing drug. This is not like taking EPO or an anabolic steroid. We used to take L-carnitine tablets back in college in the 1990s because we heard they'd help with your recovery. It's a harmless enough substance. But when you're actually injecting it into the arm in certain higher doses, that's when you're crossing a line, and that's when it's banned. And that's what Salazar really was all about. It was that grey area, and he was constantly crossing the line and seeing how much can I get away with, and what's the absolute limit. And if that's the way he did business, well then you can see why he's ended up being banned, because at some point you're going to cross the line.
If Farah was saying he took 13.5 millilitres of it before the London Marathon in 2014, but he completely blew out in that marathon.
Yeah, well, that's my point. Like, I mean, I don't think L-carnitine is going to necessarily make you run a faster marathon. This is one of a number of supplements that they were taking. And the thyroid medication as well. This is one that I did find quite disturbing. And the two American athletes were adamant. This was Kara Goucher and Adam Goucher, the two top American distance runners at the time, who both worked at Salazar, and they were taking this course of thyroid medication, which, even though they definitely didn't need thyroid medication. So, you know, the purpose being it's going to improve in weight loss, and it's going to basically make you more skinny as a distance runner, which is certainly beneficial, but not with the consequences of messing up your metabolism, messing up your heart rate. But also, I mean, the gently ironic point there was that they were taking this medication before they went to Salazar. They were actually started it themselves before that. So it's that classic grey area, like what's legal and what's not, and where do you draw the line? But certainly the problem with Mo Farah is when you keep changing your story, and especially when it comes to the people he associated himself with. But as of now, they don't have anything on him per se that they can actually ban him for. Which is why I think the critical piece in this whole puzzle is samples need to go back for retesting. And UK Athletics, as of now, to the best of my knowledge, have not made those samples available for whatever reason. And that's the one thing I think that possibly either nail or clear Mo Farah at this stage is if the samples can be retested to a level of detail that you can say, look, there's nothing here other than what we know he was taking at that point himself.
Ian, would it be slightly worrying for you that when Mo Farah did take those intravenous injections, that the UK Athletics performance director Neil Black was there, the head of distance runner Barry Fudge was there, the chief medical officer Dr. Rob Shark-Raverty was there? They were all there while he was taking it. None of them seemed to be happy with it. but they all allowed it to happen, and they're powerful people in UK athletics.
Yeah. Neil Black has since resigned from his position. He's moved on. Barry Foote also, and I mean, and the doctor you mentioned there as well. I mean, it's the classic case of, you know, I forgot to notice, and when this is a situation where he should have been very careful to be putting the evidence down to make sure everyone, you know, all the paperwork, I suppose, or the paper trail was there for everyone to see. But instead, there's actually no record of that. And again, that's the kind of stuff which doesn't shine a positive light on Mo Farah at all. It'll be interesting to see. I mean, the Salazar case, he's currently appealing his case. This is appealing the case to CAS to see. Now, Nike are actually funding this case, so it'll be interesting to see how that one pans out. And again, what Salazar was done, and he wasn't actually banned for giving athletes performance enhancing drugs. He was banned for pushing the boundaries, I suppose. And, you know, certainly the fact that he was giving his son testosterone to see how much he could actually take before he actually tested positive, that's the kind of stuff he was done for. But he wasn't actually done for giving his athletes performance enhancing drugs. I wouldn't be surprised at all if Salazar actually wins his appeal and is back on the track come Tokyo this summer.
Ian, you move in the athletic circles. What way is Mo Farah received by his peers now?
Yeah, look, I think anyone who's been close to sport, when you go back to Mo Farah, and by the way, people say he was an all-Saran and he was a nobody before he moved to Salazar. That's not strictly true. Mo Farah won a European Championship in 2010. You know, before he moved out there, so the potential was always there. There's no doubt about that. He wasn't quite an all-Saran, but it was the transformation. It was the consistency. It was the way he was able to recover. I mean, it was the way he was able to run 10,000 meters, 25 laps of the track, flat out, and get up the next day and do a 5,000 meter heat, and then win a 5,000 meter final. It was just the level of consistency I've never witnessed before in the sport. And That's where the question came from, really. Like, how was he doing this, and how is this possible? So, and then when you step back and you see this, as I say, this you know, this, how his career has developed and the people he surrounds himself with, whether it's Salazar, whether it's Jama Aden, I mentioned, and then you see programs like Last Night, which continue to sort of raise fresh questions about how he went about his business, how he kept changing his story. Yeah, I'd say Mo Farah's credibility is probably hovering somewhere close to zero right now. In other words, he hasn't got very much left. He's still talking about coming back on the track this summer to defend his 10,000 meter title for the third time. Don't forget, I don't think anybody's ever done three 10,000 meter titles in a row in the Olympics history. I'd be very surprised if he does that. And I think possibly we've certainly seen the best of Mo Farah. But how much of his reputation will survive all this? Well, I think this, as I said, I don't think there's a whole lot left of it anyway.
Should UK Athletics be investigating him, though, just like given the amount of question marks hanging over him?
Yeah, I know they came out with some really flippy statement last night. Oh, sorry, wishy-washy statement. Said, oh, yeah, we've watched this documentary with interest. If anybody has information, please come to us. I mean, talk about a sort of an after comments like this, because we've known this for years. And if you go back to Mo Farah when he was making those breakthroughs in London 2012 and the whole Salazar case, and when the Salazar accusations first emerged in 2015, that was the original BBC Panorama documentary, I think it was called Catch Me If You Can. I mean, there was loads of questions then, and that's when UK Athletics should have been really, I suppose, looking at Mo Farah and where exactly he was training. But instead, they seem to, as you suggested there, Ruby, they seem to almost take sides with him and to see to kind of protect him to some extent. And I think they're seeing the results of that now. So yeah, it's a strange one. It is a strange one to think that just an anti-doping committee that's supposed to be protecting the sport from this kind of behaviour was the one that were actually somehow allowing it or affording it or somehow. In bed with us, essentially.
Anyway, time will tell, Ian, and we'll see what happens in the next couple of weeks. Thanks for taking the call.
Thanks, Ian. Talk to you again.
See you.
Game on.
On 2FM. Weekdays from 6.